This special broadcast of U.S. Senator Mark Begich's speech to the Alaska State Legislature is produced by 360 North in Juneau. I'm Rosemary Alexander, KTOO News Director. In just a few moments, Senator Begich will be speaking to a joint session of the Alaska House of Representatives and the Senate from the state capitol here in Juneau. Right now, legislators are coming into House chambers. We see that the House just broke a few moments ago, and the senators are now trickling in, albeit slowly. Senate President Gary Stevens and House Speaker Mike Chenault will preside over the session. This is Senator Begich's fourth speech to the Alaska Legislature since he took office in 2009. Begich is the only Democrat in Alaska's congressional delegation. He serves on the Armed Services Committee, Veterans Affairs and Commerce Committee, among others. The senator has been in the state for several days. He helped kick off the Iditarod in Anchorage on Saturday, visited the Mine Training Center at the University of Alaska Southeast yesterday, and also spoke yesterday to the Juneau World Affairs Council about his recent visit to the U.S. military operations in Afghanistan. It's expected that he will talk about that shortly as he commences his speech. As a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Begich also has been working with the Pentagon to stop the proposed transfer of F-16 fighter jets from Eielson Air Force Base in Fairbanks to Elmendorf Richardson in Anchorage. He'll probably touch on that topic, too. It's a major concern to the congressional delegation. We see senators and House members still trickling into the chambers. We do know that the Senator Begich's staff has arrived, and so he's probably in the hallway waiting for the legislature to start the ceremony here and bring him in for his speech. Senator Stevens has now reached the Speaker's desk, and so in a few moments, we do expect that Senator Stevens and House Speaker Chenault will bring down the gavel, and we will start Mark Begich's fourth speech to the Alaska State Legislature. A note to the audience, as soon as he completes his speech to legislators, he will also allow questions, and that often is one of the most interesting parts of the annual address by Alaska's congressional delegation. Senator Lisa Murkowski addressed lawmakers just about 2 weeks ago, but Representative Don Young, who is Alaska's lone congressman, usually does not do a formal speech. He prefers to come to Juneau and just meet informally with legislators. Thank you. We do know that Senator Begich will be talking about one of the congressional delegation's hottest topics, and that's Arctic development. I believe I just heard House Speaker Chenault asking for order, so perhaps we're getting closer to this speech.
To the President of the Senate, the Honorable Gary Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This joint session will please come to order. The purpose of the joint session is to hear an address by the Honorable Mark Begich, United States Senator. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the Senate be waived and all members be shown present.
Without objection, so ordered. Representative Osterman.
Yeah, Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call in the House be waived and all members be shown as present.
Without objection, so ordered. Will Representative Seaton and Senator Ellis escort the Honorable Senator Begich to the joint session?
We now see Ladies Senator Begich being escorted United down the hallway Senator by the Senator Alaska, Ellis and Representative
Mark
Seaton.
Thank you very much. President Stevens, Speaker Chenault, members of the House and Senate, and friends across Alaska, it is truly good to be back home. Over the weekend, I got to celebrate the start of the last great race with thousands of Alaskans. The Iditarod is always a great reminder of our state's rugged history and pioneering spirit. It's so inspiring to see great names in the Iditarod history at the race and remembering the race. Reddington, Swenson, Mackey, Boozer, John Rowe, CV, as well as new stars like John Baker and Hugh Neff. Also, as always, when I get back, I like to engage with my constituents in Alaskans, so I did a little bit of a Alaskan outreach at the Fur Rondi Poker Tournament. Being able to read the table is a great asset to have in the U.S. Senate, I will tell you. It helps to reach across the lines and the aisles and team up with senators from both parties. We have been successful in partnering with many like-minded Democrats and Republicans on issues from gun rights, debt reduction, to housing reform, and energy and resource development. Although the pundits focus on the dysfunctions in Congress, and there's plenty of that, there are many success stories that don't make the headlines. Through my position on the Commerce Committee, we protected essential air service for rural Alaska communities in the recent FAA reauthorization. In the next few weeks, we'll ensure that bypass mail continues for Alaskans when we adopt postal reform. And thanks to legislation I supported, Alaska is the top, and we'll say this just in this room, because I know no one's watching, top recipient per person among all state and federal investments in construction, road, and port maintenance and defense. In fact, a new State Department of Labor report shows federal funding in Alaska jumped $4 billion in the last 3 years, highest and all-time high record. At the same time, Alaska faces numerous challenges. They start with the looming $15 trillion national debt, which keeps the pressure on us to rein in our federal spending. This is already causing pain in Alaska as we find ourselves targeted for cuts at Eielson Air Force Base and talk of another BRAC round. I can tell you this, without question, that the delegation, Senator Murkowski, Congressman Young, and I are united to push back on this and oppose this change. There's no question Alaska's strategic location is a unique asset for deploying troops anywhere in the world, proven by this moment we're in today. The 9,000 Alaska-based troops in Afghanistan today, men and women from the 125 and the 425 brigades and the National Guard Bravo Company, are proof of Alaska's ability to train and deploy exceptional soldiers and airmen to any battleground anywhere in this world. In January, I was honored to visit Alaska troops in Afghanistan. I found their morale high and full of pride on a job well done. And I will say that when I visited these Alaskans, it didn't matter where I was, in a small forward operating base or a large camp, they made sure they told everyone they were from Alaska. They made that point clear. So I brought them a little salmon jerky to help remind everybody. Please join me in truly honoring these great Alaskan heroes and their families that support them every single day. Let's give them a round of applause. And just to make sure you have the perspective, 10% of the force is from the Alaska stations in Afghanistan. As a member of the Senate Armed Services and Veterans Committees, I'll continue to remind President Obama and his military chiefs that our nation's future opportunities and threats are on our horizon, right here in the Pacific. Today, I want to discuss Alaska's limitless opportunities and the challenge we face achieving the full potential. Nowhere do we enjoy new opportunities more than with Alaska's Arctic resources: oil and gas, minerals, fisheries, tourism, transportation. The list goes on and on. We can best seize these opportunities by working together to invest in our facilities, in our education, and our workforce. Last year in these chambers, I noted that Alaska was at the crossroads for oil and gas development in the Arctic. At that time, we faced numerous hurdles to exploration of the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea and National Petroleum Reserve in Anwar. Today, I believe we're at the cusp of a new era of Arctic development and poised for a renaissance in Alaska's oil and gas development. For the first time in a generation, I believe we will see exploration this summer in the Arctic. And let me repeat that, this summer in the OCS Arctic for the first time in a generation. Now, it sounds great to say that, but it wasn't easy getting here. When I was elected to the Senate, Alaska spent decades looking for the next big bonanza. We all remember that old bumper sticker about just one more boom. That's all we need. For 40 years, we focused on our efforts almost exclusively on developing the Arctic National Wildlife Range, ANWR. The conventional wisdom, and many of you believed, that this new administration, and I will say some thought my election, meant Alaska would be locked up even further, with no new development on federal lands and federal waters. But you guys know me. People have worked with me for years. I took that doubt over Alaska's Arctic development and took it as a personal challenge. Today, in just 3 years, we have accomplished more than in the last 30 years to open up federal lands and waters to development. Starting with the new president on down and across political boundaries in Congress, I've argued that Alaskans can develop these resources responsibly, just as we have done for the last 40 years on the North Slope. Within my first few months in office, I brought Interior Secretary Ken Salazar here to see firsthand what we're doing, how we're doing it, who our people, how we're developing our oil and gas. And we have brought him back here every year since. And we've also arranged visits for top officials from the Coast Guard, EPA, Army Corps, NOAA, transportation, all the key players regarding oil and gas, may they be directly or indirectly. We wanted them to see and touch and feel what Alaska is about. My goal has been getting them comfortable with offshore Arctic development by showcasing the new technologies and investment in world-class science. After the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, we had to work double time. We had lost some ground with the administration and the public. As chair of the Senate Ocean Subcommittee, I worked to build the case for increased investment in Arctic science and facilities to support the development. We're proud that the former Lieutenant Governor, Fran Ulmer, is now the helm of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. She is strategically positioned to make key recommendations to the federal agencies on how to build the world's best Arctic science program. Already, Interior's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has invested, and I'm going to repeat this because it's an amazing number, invested half of its national science budget in Alaska, more than $60 million. Half of their budget is here in this state on Arctic oil and gas development. Just last summer, Shell, Conoco, Statoil signed a groundbreaking agreement with NOAA to share baseline data in the Arctic. As the first company in Alaska's Arctic, Shell has stepped up to enhance its operations, to go far beyond what is required to ensure safe and responsible development. As Coast Guard Admiral Tom Ostebo said, and I remember him saying this because I was somewhat surprised, but I thought he knows best. He's the Coast Guard Admiral. He knows what he's preparing for. And he says this: this will be the most environmentally sound, technologically advanced drilling program anywhere in the world. Anywhere in the world. In recent months, Shell has secured permits for exploratory drilling in Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. This means thousands of jobs this summer, working on drilling rigs, transporting workers, gear, supplies to rigs and associated vessels. Shell will move their rig with 23 other associated vessels to assist them in this project. After years of frustrating stalemate, and I've heard many comments from you all here over the last 2-3 years, we've received the final permits for CD5 project, the first within the National Petroleum Reserve. And you know better than anyone why that's important. ConocoPhillips plans to produce up to 18,000 barrels a day to go right into that pipeline as we look for every opportunity to fill the line. They will also provide hundreds of construction jobs and, of course, revenue for the state. These developments are great news for Alaskans. Getting here has been frustrating, I will tell you. And you've heard me call it before, the regulatory whack-a-mole by federal agencies. You knock one down, another one pops up. And if you recall last year at this podium, I talked about an idea, a piece of legislation that I introduced and cut through all this federal maze to create a cross-agency coordinator for offshore development. A month later, the president took up the idea and ran with it. The Interior Department Secretary David Hayes was appointed to head a new federal coordinating working group for Alaska energy development. And you are seeing the results of that, because now agencies are working together, focused on the end result, and not having contradictory comments back and forth, but figuring out how to move things forward. He was just in Alaska, and the group is making the permitting, as I said, less bumpy for Conoco and Statoil as the next two large developments. A year ago, I proposed, right here, moving air permitting from Arctic offshore development from EPA back to Interior. Check that off the list. That is done. As we clear the way for Arctic development, we must build critical facilities and equipment necessary to support its development. This means Coast Guard vessels and icebreakers, a deep water port, a communication backbone, and support for Arctic shipping. We're making some progress here. The Coast Guard recently briefed me about the helicopters and cutters and other assets they have assembled to participate in this summer's activity. And as they finish that analysis and work this summer, we will spend the time through our committee to analyze the additional resources they will need as we continue to develop the Arctic. This marks a significant change to the Arctic. It is as a new ocean has just been opened up, and the Coast Guard, which in fact is just what's happening. The nation must provide the ships, the aircraft, the bases, and the men and women to fill these responsibilities for the Coast Guard in the Arctic. Despite dramatic budget cuts in every federal agency, the Coast Guard is slated to receive a modest increase this year, budget to design a new, sorely needed icebreaker. Now we're years away from the vessel doing its essential mission, so I'm working with the Coast Guard to ensure that they reactivate the Polar Star this year and prevent her sister ship, the Polar Sea, from being decommissioned. We estimate that just a little bit of work on those two ships, we can keep them active. And we've seen more recently, as you all know, what the Healy can do in regards to Nome and making sure they had the fuel. Along with this fleet of privately owned ice-capable vessels, this will put Alaska and the United States back on the track in the Arctic. Still, our work is not done. We need to secure federal, state, and private resources to support the Arctic development for the long term. That's why, as the chair of the Senate Ocean Subcommittee, I've just introduced the Arctic Science Endowment Fund. My bill creates and funds basic science in the Arctic Ocean, helping pave the way for responsible Arctic development. As we develop our Arctic and oil and gas resource, we must heed the wisdom of former mayor of the North Slope Borough, Mayor Edward Itta. He reminds us that as development in the Arctic comes and goes, it is the Inupiat people who remain subsisting on the region's rich natural resources. I believe we all have a role in educating the American public about our role as the nation in the new Arctic economy. We cannot cede our ground to Russia, Canada, or China. Believe me, they are not waiting. They are moving forward at an aggressive pace. These countries are investing right now in deep water ports, ships, resources, mapping, and more. China, which isn't, well, they may think they're an Arctic nation, but they're not. But they are busy enacting like one. They are seeking participation in the Arctic Council and is building new vessels to supplement the Ice Dragon, their current icebreaker. Meanwhile, the United States still has not ratified the Law of the Sea, and I will tell you, I thank the legislature for your work and continuing to support the efforts, which provides us international framework to exercise our rights in the Arctic. Let me commend again a couple other folks, and first Representative Jewell and Senator Stedman as chairs of the Northern Waters Task Force. Thank you all for doing the work you do. Your work clearly makes the case for more active partnership between the state of Alaska and the federal government to responsibly meet challenges and opportunities in the changing Arctic. Now is the time to invest in Alaska resources, to match federal and private funding to develop a deep water port, advanced marine navigational aids, high-speed broadband, affordable, reliable, alternative Arctic energy sources to power this economic growth. Now is the time to make these investments. Alaska must prepare now for the thousands of new jobs produced by this new Arctic development. Two Alaskan think tanks, the Institute on Social and Economic Research and Northern Economics, estimate more than 50,000 jobs nationwide just from Arctic offshore oil and gas development. This doesn't account for the thousands of additional jobs created by mineral development, shipping, tourism, and many other aspects of what could go on in the Arctic. In Alaska alone, we'll see thousands of jobs for engineers, welders, carpenters, mariners, pilots, roustabouts, roughnecks, drillers, mechanics, electricians, laborers. The list goes on and on, the amount of capacity and potential for us in the Arctic. We need to fill this jobs pipeline with our workers. Alaskan grown, Alaskan trained. We should start from Alaskans from the Arctic communities of Wainwright and Nome and Kotzebue, Barrow, Kaktovik. Everywhere throughout Alaska, we should be drawing Alaskans to work in this new opportunity for this great Arctic development. And we need to get started now. After exploratory drilling this summer, it will take 10 to 12 years to get those oil and gas developments into full development. That may seem like a lot of time, and a long time from now, but let me put it in perspective. Think about it. If you're a kindergarten in today, and we're drilling in 2025, you'll be the right age to start working in that arena. But now is the time. Alaska schools and universities' training programs have joint responsibility to prepare Alaskans for these jobs. Again, let's fill these job pipeline by investing now in three critical areas: good health, early education, and emphasis on science and math and career and technical education programs. First, we must ensure that Alaskans get off to a strong start, a healthy start, through programs like Denali KidCare. Shamefully, today, Alaska ranks 49th, worst among the states when it comes to eligibility for this nationally accepted program. Helping women and kids afford to see a doctor is another form of respect in improving our economy in the long term. The next step just should be a commitment to effective early education programs. We all want our Alaskan kids who are ready to learn and ready to succeed when they enter school. As I said, just imagine a kindergarten student today. In 2025 is when the Arctic will be at its development starting point. Those kids will be available to start working in that field. To get these Alaskans graduating from our schools, we need to invest early. All the data shows early education is the best investment. For every dollar you put down, you get a $16 return. There is no question about it. No one debates this. But it's about a simple investment to ensure our young people are prepared. Of the 40 states with any sort of public pre-K, Alaska is ranked 38th, with less than 2% of our kids enrolled. We can do better than this. There is no question in my mind. I commend Senators French and Davis and others for your efforts to make pre-K funding available in Alaska. As I mentioned, the payoff is amazing. $1 for 16. And I see it everywhere I go, young people. When I go out to rural Alaska and these young people have had access to Head Start, you can see the difference. You can talk to the teachers. You can talk to the parents. You can see the difference. I remember I was back on one of my 48-hour, 72-hour moments here in Alaska as I come back and go, and it was snowing in Anchorage pretty heavy. And, you know, usually, as you all know, when you do events and it's snowing, the odds are people show up diminishes very rapidly. And so I went to this event that we had put together full up. 50-some people showed up, all about the issue of early education. Their parents and educators and people who are just concerned about what are we doing to prepare our young people for this century? Where's the investment going to be? From that conversation came the idea for three bills, which I will introduce soon to address the access, quality, affordability, and early education. First, bill that we'll introduce will increase the child care tax credit so parents can afford to put their children in quality early child development programs. Right now, a family can pay upwards to $1,400 a month for two kids. For most working families, that's not only a hardship, it's out of reach. They will never be able to do it. Because employees of early childhood programs tend to earn low wages, we also plan to offer a tax credit for up to $3,000. Second, we will create a new student loan forgiveness program for graduates of associates and bachelor's programs in early education. Well-trained educators providing quality early education to our children makes all the difference in the child's success. And third, we need to reward companies offering on-site or near-site childcare with a company cost share. We know it works for the companies, for employers. And just to give you a couple examples, BP, Credit Union One, Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, all offer quality on-site daycare and education centers. They know it makes productive employees. Through the new tax incentive for small and medium-sized companies, we can help more Alaskan companies do this. Next, we need to target today's students, elementary, middle, and high school. with expanded, more rigorous science and math education opportunities. These are Alaskans who will fill the engineering, construction, science, accounting, management jobs created by the opening of Alaska's Arctic. Just this morning, I was able to visit Lori Hagee's kids at Glacier Valley Elementary School. They have added A to STEAM, science, technology, engineering, and math. They've now added an A for art, integrating art into science and technology, engineering, and math. Lori has demonstrated that even kindergartners can start integrated basic math and engineering with music to expand their learning. I'm so pleased that Lori has joined us. I know you acknowledged her earlier, but let's give her another round of applause for doing such a great job. I will have to tell you, Lori, and to the members here, I don't know if anyone's been out there to the program. You should go out there. I know the way I got my son interested. He loves math. And we talked to him about piano, and, you know, kids are kids, not necessarily excited. He was 8 when we suggested, but then we showed him the keys with the numbers instead of the letters. He got very excited about it, very excited. Now, we just did his recital 2 nights ago, and we loved it because he did a classical piece, and then he transitioned into Lady Gaga on piano. But his knowledge, he did it, I took piano, and I was amazed, all by memory, all the pieces. But your mind, when you add art, and you add science, and math, and technology, when you meld that all together, you get an incredible student that can do incredible things. I saw it, and it was amazing. They made me get on a violin. I wasn't that good. But it was great to have, I think I was a kindergartner or first grade. I was trying, and she just jumped right in there. The confidence level was unbelievable. She just grabbed, no, you need to put your finger like this. You need to, and it was so exciting, but they excited about it, but they were seeing the combination. Or watching fourth grade boys, and I have to tell you, my son's a fourth grader, doing ballroom dancing with fourth grade girls. And that's like, I remember when I was a kid. I hibernated in the corner and hoped someone would ask me to dance. But these kids, and what was amazing was not that the dancing, but the respect they showed each other. The conversation, the kids all had to tuck in their shirts. And I mean, it's just amazing to watch these young boys. And I asked them, because, you know, if you ask my son, does he want to dance with a girl? The answer would be, are you kidding me? These guys were just so excited because it was a mutual respect of each other, who they were as people. Why is that important? Because later in life, as many of the issues we deal with here in Alaska, as the governor's dealing with some of his initiatives, the respect of one another is a critical piece of how we understand how to deal with challenges in the future. So I can't say enough. I mean, that moment out there was exciting. These kids were incredible power and presentation and confidence. I'm telling you, any of the Juneau legislators, I'd be very nervous right now. They are well-versed. But, and again, as I said, STEM courses, STEAM courses are important. They will prepare our kids for now and into the future, but they have to have investments now. UAA's ANSEP Summer Academy is a great example, which we should replicate around the state. Last summer, I watched these seventh graders, take apart computers and rebuild these computers. Unbelievable what they were doing. And they were excited about it. It wasn't like, oh, I have to be here because my parents told me to be here. They wanted to be there. We should replicate this. Oil and gas companies are investing in this program because they see the reward. They see the job skills these kids will graduate with. Ensuring Alaska schools offer strong STEM programs means we have to get out from under the rigid rules of no child left behind. We have to get out of this for good. I've criticized, as you know, this legislation time and time again. It is a plan from Washington that has really hurt us here in Alaska. That's why I've encouraged on a regular basis, even minutes ago, the governor to apply for the waiver to the No Child Left Behind. 37 states with Republican and Democratic governors already have done so. Some have received them, others are waiting to receive their applications and waivers. Let's truly get the federal bureaucracy out of our local education system. And I know you have a resolution moving through, and I would hope that you'd all support it. I think it's an incredible step in the right direction. Finally, we need to invest in job training and apprenticeship programs so Alaska high school graduates have multiple choices when you do consider careers in high-demand trade jobs created by Arctic Development. I've toured many of these facilities all around the state, including the new mining program at UAS just yesterday. If you haven't taken the simulator, you should. It's an amazing piece of equipment, the only one in the United States, the only one. And it will train not only our students, but potentially other students to be in the new fields. We need to make bigger investments now to ensure we have the capacity in 5 years when Arctic construction projects get underway. It means expanding current programs, but also developing new marine training programs to produce our deckhands, engineers, and captains in the fishing industry. This requires new partnerships, new funding. The ICER and Northern Economic Study estimates more than $15 billion in state and local government revenues from Arctic offshore development. And this is a conservative number. This is based on $65 a barrel. I challenge the state to work with local governments now to create a new Arctic Workforce Partnership Fund. The goal is building a network of job training and apprenticeship technical education centers to ensure Alaskans from across the state have the skills and to fill these jobs and to fill the jobs pipeline. We already have great start with the Fairbanks Pipeline Training Center, the Ute Learning Center in Bethel, Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center in Nome, and of course, Avtech in Seward. But coordinating these and figuring out where the gaps are and filling them will be critical for us to own and have those jobs for this generation and the future generation. Just as the jobs for the Arctic development should be filled by Alaskans, so should the financial benefits of Arctic development from Alaska. That's why one of the first bills I introduced when I came to the Senate was to provide Alaska revenue sharing from the Outer Continental Shelf, the same as the Gulf of Mexico states receive, 37.5% of the bonus bids, royalty payments, rental payments. This could mean millions of dollars per year and billions over the time and development of those areas. My bill shares these new revenues with all Alaskans and all communities. At the same time, we need to share the small business opportunities with Alaskans across the state. Thousands of secondary jobs will be created around small business opportunities on Arctic development. From shipbuilding in Ketchikan, fuel and goods commerce in Dutch Harbor and Barrow, drilling supplies from Anchorage and Fairbanks, helicopter, aircraft charters, you name it, it's going to be attached to Arctic development. This is huge. It's beyond, I think, any of us can imagine what the potential of the Arctic is. Arctic development will bring federal resources from the Coast Guard, Interior, NOAA, just to name a few. Already this summer, the Coast Guard plans to deploy 2 cutters, 2 helicopters to the Arctic and bringing back the Healy. As Shell and Conoco and Statoil move forward on exploration and production, the federal presence will expand. As chair of the Senate Oceans Subcommittee, I will be grilling both NOAA and the Coast Guard when they come before my committee this week on the long-term investments needed in the Arctic. Of course, we're all waiting for the launch of the UAF's research vessel, the Skuliak. The new ice-capable ship will be home-ported in Seward and create dozens of new research jobs. This is a ship we have waited 37 years for. I was very proud to support this. This is an incredible piece to this long-term equation of the new commitment to Alaska. Just as we fill the jobs pipeline for Alaskans, we need to fill this Arctic commerce pipeline with Arctic Alaska small businesses and entrepreneurs. That's why we've championed and I've championed federal support for small business development. Through passage of the Small Business Jobs Act, that seeded Anchorage's $13 million 49 state angel fund by extending the payroll tax cut, which will help 20,000 Alaska small businesses cut the payroll tax, which also will help 400,000 Alaskans put $300 million back into their pocket. With tax reform and lower tax rates for small businesses, streamline access to capital from SBA, just to name a few things we're doing back in Washington to try to make sure there's more access for small businesses. Through a state and federal partnership, we can truly spark new industries. Just one example, exciting opportunities from research development and manufacturing is the unmanned aerial vehicles. Some of you have heard my rant on this already. To me, this is an incredible opportunity that's sitting in front of us. In the next 4 months, FAA and the Defense Department will designate 6 centers for the UAV. Now, coincidentally, I sit on both those committees. Both those bills had language put in there specifically to find these six sites. Now, I believe Alaska should be one of those. That's why that language is in there. The university, absolutely. The University of Alaska Fairbanks, in my view, should be one. It's already has significant experience developing testing of UAVs, and thanks to, again, that provision, it is giving us a chance to be a contender. Let me give you a data point. Department of Defense has purchased more unmanned aircraft in the last 3 years than manned aircraft. That's the future. And if we want to be the best, we want to have something to offer to the world and to this country, we have the chance to do it. Right now, Airborne Technologies in Wasilla is utilizing Alaska-built, Alaska-tested UAVs in fisheries research. UAVs also will be critical for used and was used in the Nome refueling and will be used extensively in Arctic research and development. And I challenge the legislature. This is a point not to think small, not to have the university come down for a couple $100,000 request. If we want to compete and we want to be the best in this arena, we have the best airspace. When you're up in the Fairbanks region, we have the largest open airspace anywhere in the country, anywhere. We have the ability with our universities, and we have the ingenuity of our small business people across the state. But it's not about a $250,000 investment. It's not a $500,000 investment. My challenge to the legislature is say, step up to the plate, put $5 million on the table, compete, be one of the six in the nation. Because if we're first in, we will be the hallmark of UAV development. And that is a huge future for us. I would encourage you to think about it. Now, let me close by just saying it's been an enormous honor to be serving Alaska for Alaska for the last 3 years in the Senate. I said last night to a group, and I'll say it here, there's no question what we do all the time. We put Alaska always first. When people ask me, how do you like living in Washington, D.C., I always remind them, I work in Washington, D.C., I live here. This is who I represent. It doesn't matter if you're a Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal, Green Party, Tea Party, it doesn't matter. What we have is an enormous potential for us as a state. The question is, are we going to grab it, and are we going to move it forward? And there are morsels of opportunity sitting on our doorstep. It's just the question, are we going to think in those days when Alaska had nothing and we thought big, is that our moment today? I believe it is. When I look at the Arctic and see what the potential is, it's beyond what anyone can imagine what's out there. And there's no better place but to take advantage of that than right here in Alaska. We have the people, we have the resources, we have the ingenuity, and we have the willpower to make things happen. So it is always a pleasure to be back here because I get a chance to give you a little update, and you know me, I'm always optimistic. I see the future, I'm excited about the future. When I was out to school today, it is an incredible opportunity we can provide for these young people if we grab the moment. And today is the moment with the Arctic and many other things we're developing. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless this great state and our great country. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Begich. The Senator has agreed to take some questions. We'll begin with Representative Garrett.
Mr. President, Senator Begich, welcome home.
Thank you.
I'm still getting over the fact that you stole my staff 3 years ago.
And people still remind me that I stole two-thirds of his staff, and I apologize. It's all for one cause.
But somehow you gave them a smaller office than they had before. So.
They tell me that.
Senator, in fairness, I asked this to Senator Murkowski when she was here. So a couple of years ago, the Supreme Court passed the Citizens United case that gave unions and corporations the ability to make unlimited election expenditures. I'd like to know your opinion on that, your opinion on a response like a constitutional amendment, which we have a resolution to push for, whether if the states send you resolutions, whether that's worth it in pushing the cause forward. And then on the related issue, right now you can do what we did in this state and you tried in Congress, which was the Disclose Act, which would have forced companies to at least, or independent groups to at least list their top three donors. That failed, unfortunately, on a filibuster. But your views on Citizens United, the Disclose Act, sure, and whether a resolution would help.
I think the Supreme Court decision was a bad decision. All you have to do is look around the country and see these super PACs, and it's very corrosive to the political process. It is unbelievable that people can just drop $10 million down and influence an election overnight. And that's what's happening. That's why you see some of these national primaries moving all over the place, because this money is just flowing in. So I support the Disclose Act from a federal end, that we think there should be steps to ensure that if you contribute, you need to disclose who you are, where you come from, in the sense of if you're a corporation. I think that's very important. And so I commend the Alaska legislature for moving legislation of that nature forward, because I think the people are very discouraged out there by what's happening with the, as I said, the corrosive parts of politics with the money that's being poured in. So I absolutely support it. I support a constitutional amendment. I'm actually a sponsor. I think there's only, we were talking a little bit, and I think there's only two or three of us on it so far. I think any state that brings a resolution forward and says we should do this from a constitutional standpoint is helpful. So when you do those resolutions, why is that important? Because it's kind of a reverse of the action usually taken. Usually we pass something, the states take action. By having that tells us states are interested, and I think that's important. So if you do a resolution and make that point on the Constitution, I'd be very happy to share with my colleagues. But we have to fix this, or it's going to be very corrosive long term. And I see people who are just so disappointed in what's going on because of the money influence now. So I support a Disclose Act on the federal level. Supreme Court, I think, was wrong. Anything you can do to support a constitutional amendment by encouraging it through resolution would be helpful.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. good to see you again, Senator. Yes. Can you, you talked a little bit about some of the things you're doing on the federal level to help Alaska's kids and youth. And one of the problems that I hear and that we all hear are the problems with veterans unemployment and veterans training. And we've taken some bipartisan action on the state level. And can you talk a little bit about some of the things that are happening on the federal level?
Absolutely. You know, again, keep in mind, Alaska has the highest percentage of veterans per capita in the nation, 70 plus thousand. So from our perspective, very important. I sit on the Veterans Committee, Armed Services Committee, both have direct and indirect relationship to what goes on with the veterans community. And let me put in one more perspective. As the wars wind down, we will have thousands and thousands and thousands of veterans that will need not only immediate care, but long-term care. And we also will need to ensure they have an opportunity to get jobs and move back into society. The challenge is unemployment rate among veterans is almost double what the national average is, or state average, depending on which state you're in. It is a significant problem. One of the things we're working on, I would encourage even here on a state level, on a national level, we have a piece of legislation, administration starting to move forward on some administrative actions, is if you are a medic on the front lines in Afghanistan, I can speak to this, I was in Afghanistan about 4 weeks ago, if you're on the front line and you're a medic, when you come back to this country, probably the best job, and I know this for a fact because we did a press event with several of these folks, you're going to be an ambulance driver because you're not certified. So you have to go through this whole process to get certified. Well, if you're a veteran and you're coming out of the military, you want to transition into something as soon as possible, not a year or two or three or 4 years later. So we're trying to create some standards that people can take that skill and transfer it. I think in a lot of ways, through your own occupational licensing programs here in the state, you can do some things. CDL licenses. I mean, if you're driving a truck in Afghanistan, I'm going to tell you something. If you're driving a fuel truck in Afghanistan, you can drive any place, probably in Alaska. I guarantee you have that. But they have to come back, get a whole CDL license, and go through a whole process. So we're trying to do some things on the federal end to help unify some of that. There's a group of labor and individuals called Helmets to Hard Hats. It's a really good program where they're trying to meld these things. That, to me, is important. We're doing some things for families. You know, and I brought this up yesterday when I gave a presentation. When I first came in the office, we have, and I know them, I visit them, I talk to their families, I call them. Wounded Warriors are an incredible group of people. But to get services, you have choices. You can institutionalize them if they are severe, or give the care at home. The problem was when giving care at home, the spouse or the significant other or the family member had to give up usually their job. Very incredible hardship for them. We passed legislation to make sure if they do that, we're going to give them compensation. that we want them to be with their loved ones at home, helping them rehabilitate, get back with a life, and continue to move forward. But we had to pass a law to do something that seems so common sense. So we're doing some things right now. We're getting closer on an issue I've brought up here before and with members on the Heroes Card, Alaska Heroes Card. This will mean that if you're a veteran in a rural part of Alaska, in a roadless area, and you need care, you don't have to fly all the way to Anchorage or Seattle. If there is, for example, in Nome, a beautiful new federally funded hospital, which I'm happy to say I voted for, completed, and you can get the service there, you should go right across the street and get that service. You should not have to fly all around the country to go get service if you're a veteran. We are getting closer and closer to figuring out that and solving that problem. That will be huge to rural veterans, which are more and more veterans are living in rural parts of our country and our state. So creating access here in Southeast would be another example. You only have a small clinic here, and then you have to go to Seattle or Anchorage if you're a veteran. But if you can access any of the federally funded healthcare clinics here, then they can get their service right here. But they always will have the choice. They can go to their VA program, or they can access. So there's a variety of things we're trying to do to help improve the access of healthcare for veterans, family care, family support services, and making sure they also have long-term benefits to access education and job opportunities. So there's quite a few things we're working on.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. President. Welcome back to Alaska, Senator Begich. I really appreciate the comments you've been making about military and the veterans. Along that line, what are your comments on the administration's current attack on TRICARE, health benefits for retirees?
Yeah.
As I understand it, it looks like they're trying to balance the budget on the back of the military. As I understand it, there's some kind of a means test being proposed, and it seems to me that when our military raised their hands to volunteer or be enlisted, they passed that means test, and when they went in the service and got shot at, perhaps injured, maybe even killed, that means test was passed. What are your comments on that, sir? And are you in a good position here being on these military committees?
Yeah, no, this is a battle we've had now 2 years running. And here's what I always remember, and General Shinseki, the administrator of the VA, the secretary was with me up in Bethel, and I remember we were having a little forum with veterans, and this veteran came, he's a Vietnam veteran, came and brought his brochure, the brochure he got when he enlisted. He says, I just want to show you what they told me I was supposed to get, and now they want to take it away from me. I mean, he held this, and he gave it to me, he says, I want you to hold this and keep this so you remember what we signed up to do. And so last year's committee, this year's committee work, we've opposed it time and time again. Because just for the reason you said, Bob, and that is when they raise their hand, that's the means test. They've made a decision. They've volunteered, especially now, to participate. So we have an obligation. Now, some of us may say that obligation is expensive. Well, they volunteered. This is the commitment we make. Now, is there areas that we should be focused on in the military that we should try to curtail some of the expenditure? Yes, but not on the backs of the people who serve in the military. And I can give you, and I've given example after example. I've gotten last year in the Defense Authorization Bill, I think I had the single largest single reduction unanimously supported by the committee on a project that the federal government was never going to use. But we're going to pay for it because that was a cheaper way to get out of it. And I used the old rule that all these contracts are subject to appropriation. So we just don't appropriate the money to those programs that are wasteful. And I was amazed because I was bringing it forward, and Senator McCain came up to me and said, you know, I'd like to lead on this one. Can I lead on it? I said, sure. And before we were done, we had unanimous support on a project that was an $800 million project that we were never going to use. So instead of working on that, they focus on TRICARE, or they focus on minimizing benefits, or making sure families may not have all the support services they need when their loved ones are overseas. So you probably get a sense here where I'm at on this. I am passionate about this because I go to the bases, as many of you I know do. I see these military families. I talk to them. And the least we can do is hold our commitment to what we said we would do when they signed up. I mean, that's the least. So You'll see us in the battlefield again, right in the arena. And I don't care if it's the president or whoever else is proposing it. We will oppose them and fight on these issues. We have no problem with doing that. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Senator, for being with us today. You talked in your remarks about the importance of education and the importance of vocational and technical training, and thank you for highlighting those. You also talked about the frustration that I think all of us in this room have felt over the years with No Child Left Behind and the fact that it's not very well tailored to Alaska. Unfortunately, the state of Alaska didn't take advantage of its first opportunity to apply for a waiver,
right.
But my understanding is we've got another application period coming up this fall. I was wondering if you could tell us, since we have to actually apply for the waiver and be granted it, what should we be doing to try to set Alaska up to take advantage of the waiver?
Yeah, I mean, I hate the law. I think it's done a lot of damage. You know, when I campaigned, I actually took the law and bound it in a book because I was curious how thick it would be. It's like this thick. And oddly enough, my son saw this. I was in our home in D.C. I had it on a shelf, and he pulled it down. This was like a week ago. Pulled it down, opened it up, and started looking because we were trying to figure out another book to read because we read every night. And I thought, oh my God, that thing's at it. Please, no. But he opens it up and starts, and he says to me, I couldn't believe it, says, I don't understand what they're saying here. And I said, welcome to my world. But he just then closed the book and said, put it right back on the shelf. And I said, he has the right attitude. But here's the challenge. September is the next one. We know many other states, again, Democrat, Republican, there is no partisan issue here. People are fed up with this law and how it has micromanaged local school districts, states, education systems. And those folks are applying for a September round. And they're probably going to get it. And also that will tell you something about the law. With so many wanting waivers, obviously there's something wrong with it. And I'm hopeful, you know, I have encouraged the governor. I know there's legislative resolution here to try to encourage the state to do it. I don't see a downside from getting out from underneath No Child Left Behind, knowing that Alaska wants to have great standards, high standards. Of course we do. And we should keep on that track. But let's not get subjected to what the feds are now requiring us to do. And I just think the faster we get out from that, the quicker you can move in a state perspective, in a local community perspective, on setting your own parameters of what levels you want to achieve. And what works in Juneau may not work in Nome. What works in Nome may not work in Fairbanks, in Anchorage, and we should keep that all in perspective. But the thing I've learned in Washington the last 3 years is clearly they always have the plan. They're just not sure how to implement it properly. And this is one example. So I think pushing for it, you know, you can do both tracks. Get out from underneath and keep our standards moving forward with the State Board of Education, which I know they're moving forward on. There's no problem with keeping those both simultaneous.
Thank you, Senator. If we haven't worn you down, we have two questions left from Representative Feige and Representative Gardner. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator. During your speech, you made comments regarding the number of UAVs that have been procured versus manned aircraft, and that got me to thinking. Over the years, my West Point classmates have had considerable success on the ground defending the interests of this country, and they've been able to do it in large measure because they owned the airspace above them and didn't have to look over their shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
Lately, within the last year or two, the Chinese have rolled out a stealth fighter of their version, of their design.
Right.
It looks remarkably like an F-22, I might add.
Yes, it does.
We stopped production at F-22.
That's just a coincidence, you know.
That's what worries me, sir.
Yeah.
We have only procured less than 200. I forget the exact number. I think it's 180 something.
Yeah, just shy of 200.
But that gives me pause because I wonder, do we have enough to maintain air superiority for our country? Alaska's kind of beyond the lower 48 and it's probably the first stop for any mm-hmm. Chinese adventurism. What is your position on restarting F-22 production?
Yeah, we, as you know, first off in Anchorage, at J-Bear there, we're going to see some more F-20. I think there's four more coming in, which is important. I don't think we'll see the new production move forward. The biggest platform that we're focused on right now is the F-35s. These are the platform of the future. They're not the stealth, but they're the taking place of the 16s and both in on our nation as well as a couple others that we're partnering with. So I don't think you'll see the F-22. I've supported the restart in the past. I don't know if we'll get there because we never have enough votes, to be very frank with you. We have a magic number in the Senate these days. If you don't have 60 votes, you can't, you know, sneeze. You can't talk. You can't, you know, do anything, which is somewhat ridiculous, to be very frank with you. So we've been unable to secure votes for long term. But the F-35 is, in my view, for Alaska, has huge potential. And especially for the Fairbanks region, folks, I think there's a huge potential long term. And that's a 10, 15, 20 year horizon out there. And that's the platform that's being focused on. I'm a big fan of it. Actually, I spend a lot of time because we don't have enough in production. And that's the problem. And the key on the production, the president's budget continues to flatline it on the production. Well, the problem with that is if I tell you I'm going to produce 30, but I say I can do 50, the odds are price per unit is going to be less. But if we don't ask that question, we'll never know. So no one's asking that. So we're starting to ask that. What's a 50? What's a 100 unit development per year? Because the F-35 is our long term. Why do I want more of those guys? Because they're going to have, my bet is over long term, Alaska is positioned to go after those as a positioning. But 22s are going to be hard to restart based on the politics of the votes right now. That's the challenge we have. I will also say, I can't go into all the detail because we have these special meetings that we call the bunker we go to, but we have our eyes, you know, wide open. There's a reason why you heard the Defense Department move to an Asian Pacific strategy now. There's a reason. You partially mentioned it, but I will just say there's a reason. And for us, you know, we're right here. There's no better location other than Hawaii, which Senator Inouye will tell me that all the time. Yeah. But the locations in the partnership between Hawaii and Alaska, we are in the best position for the long-term Pacific Asian strategy. That's why you see Fort Greely robust. 3 years ago, I don't know what was going to happen to it. Today, it's part of an aggressive platform in the sense of national defense. But again, I think on the issue of the UAVs, that's a big part of the future because we can send those things out for a long term. And if you heard some descriptions of the folks that we've used these on, to be very frank with you, they can hear them, but they can't see them. They can see them, but they can't hear because the speed of the artillery moves at the speed of sound. It's unbelievable. The technology, you could be in a room like this. No, I'm just picking this out randomly, so don't get mad at me. If they wanted to take out this little zone here, and I'm just kind of generally saying, this zone would probably have minimal damage. It's unbelievable, the technology where we're at. But again, probably not movement on F-22s at this point, but F-35's long-term non-stealth platform and UAVs are a big part of the future.
Thank you, Senator. Did you include the co-chair of finance in that? I wasn't sure.
Have they done a bad job or something?
Our final question is from Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. President and Senator Begich, I want to thank you for your work for revenue sharing to get Alaska a share of that. And as we argue for the right to develop resources in the state and argue that we can do it responsibly, we are confronted by the problem of the legacy wells drilled decades ago, abandoned by the BLM, and some of them are capped, many are leaking, some are lost. And that creates a problem when we argue that we can do things right when those photographs are out there. And I want to recognize the representative from District 30 who worked on a resolution that passed this body recently. So I've met with people from the Department of the Interior and with the BLM. I believe that they recognize the problem and they are in sympathy with us. But the real problem is money to clean it up, and it's very, very expensive. So what do you think is the prospect of finding funding to start this very expensive project?
You know, it's interesting. When I saw the discussion on this starting to materialize in the legislature, which I want to say thank you guys for doing that, within my first 2 months in office, and literally I was meeting with some folks this last week, I leaned over, pulled it right off of my desk. In my first 2 months in office, I got a report on legacy wells. because we heard from the commission, the Oil and Gas Commission, on this issue. And here's the challenge. As you know, and you said the money issue, it's probably one well a year is basically what they've projected, which is somewhat appalling. But I don't look at it as bad on our end. This is the federal government's responsibility. This isn't the private sector who's managing these wells and letting them do what they're doing. This is actually an argument I actually use against the Interior Department, saying, see how bad you do it, look how good we do it. It's actually an interesting argument because they don't like that argument, because they're responsible. It's not like, you know, Conoco or Stat or BP are responsible for those. They are, and they are letting them deteriorate. So that's the first thing we do with it. I do. I use it as actually an argument to explain, you know, if you just had a private sector folks come in there, we could clean that all up and make it look better. Now, the second part is the Interior Department has a challenge with their priorities on funding, and they need more money. There's no question about that. But how they prioritize their money. You know, 2 years ago, we argued they wanted to do their annual, or every 15 years, they got to do a plan for ANWR, which, of course, we could have written the plan for about $3 down at the Red Dog, probably, and it would have been easy. But the fact is, they spent $1.4 million doing that. The same agency that has these legacy wells and land entitlements that erode to us, that they keep cutting that budget. So what we have to do is not only find out if we can get some additional resources to clean up this mess, but also we need to have them prioritize their money properly. Because they spent, and guess where that report is? It's on some shelf. It's a very expensive report. It was sitting on a shelf. No one's going to use it. 15 years from now, they'll be required to do another one. And I'm sure we will do another one, because that's what the law says. But, I mean, that's the example. So I agree with you. There needs to be additional resource. But also, Interior Department has to prioritize some of their expenditure. That was a total waste they spent up there, 1.4. They could have put that money into legacy wells as well as some other work. No question. But those photos are powerful that I get to use when I sit there and listen to them say, you know, pick the company, can't do it right in Alaska. Well, leave it to you guys, Interior Department, look what happens, you know, or BLM in this case. So I think there's a great argument we use. I will also, if I can just give one quick thing that I know we're at the end, but the Keystone Pipeline, people ask me all about that, and, you know, we support it, we're aggressive about it, but I actually love the debate. I love the debate, and here's why. Because when people come to me and talk about Keystone, I explain to them that, you know, we would not be in this debate if we would have been in ANWR 10 years ago, because that's where we would have had this resource coming from. So people make choices by policy decisions, and I actually get to use this as a debate about policy, that when you make these kind of decisions, may they be in a political moment, you will have generational impact. So we have to be careful what we do. And we use this not necessarily always about ANWR, but we do it around the Arctic, that let's make the right decision so the long term is it's our jobs, our oil, our gas, our resource, our people working, rather than what we're engaged in now. I mean, why is oil at, I don't know what it is today, 108, 110, whatever the range is? Because we're worried about what might happen with Iran, because we don't have our own full supply. And I end on this note and just say, thanks to you folks, I get to talk about your priority on renewable energy as a state. I get to brag about how far we have come and how far you want to go. People think back in D.C. that Alaska is all about just straight oil and gas, that we don't care about renewables, we don't care about the full energy picture. And when I explain what we're doing and what you all are doing and the resources you're investing and trying to get us to 50% renewable, I think by 2025 or 2035, whatever that year is, that's an incredible argument I get. These people are blown away by that. Sorry, Alaska? I say, absolutely. We understand the balance of energy, but don't lock up our energy for the betterment of this country. But let's make sure you look at a state that actually is managing our natural resources the right way, managing our lands the right way. We understand the environment. We know it all. So it's actually thank you for giving me that kind of tool out there. So that's how I use the legacy, and that's how I use your initiatives on energy supply for this country. So thank you very much. Thank you all very much. Thank you for the time.
This special broadcast of U.S. Senator Mark Begich's address to the Alaska State Legislature has been produced by 360 North, Gavel, Alaska, in Juneau. Our radio audience now leaves us. Coverage of Senator Begich's press conference continues on 360 North Gavel, Alaska. Thank you for joining us.